Welcome to Profoundly Pointless. My name is Nick VinZant. Coming up in this episode, addiction and the top five things you don't want to buy cheap.
People seem to be more attached not to the win, but to that moment right before they know whether it's a win or a near miss. So most people are like, oh, I bet you people lie because they don't want to share about their sex life. It's actually not typically that. It's the issue for getting the truth from people is that our own perceptions of our behavior shape what we see about ourselves. So anything you do that makes you safer and more likely to wake up tomorrow, even in the midst of your addiction, that's breaking part of the cycle.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, subscribe, leave us a rating or a review. We really appreciate it. It helps out the show. And more than anything, we just like hearing from people. So I want to get right to our first guest. He's an addiction researcher who specializes in gambling and sex addiction. This is Dr. Joshua Grubbs. What is addiction, basically?
It's not an easy answer. This is one that if you ask someone on the street, what is an addiction? I think they might actually be able to come up with an answer more quickly than most psychologists or specialists could, because this is something that's still debated. Now, broadly speaking, when we say addiction, what we tend to mean is a pattern of excessive or compulsive behavior, a behavior that's out of control. Someone feels like they cannot stop, that they try to stop, but they can't. Even though that behavior is getting in the way of their lives, it's causing problems. Normally, most professionals would also say that there's a chemical piece as well, right? There's this notion that there's things going on in your brain with neurotransmitters, typically being altered via and the introduction of a chemical from outside the system. But the core of it is this inability to stop despite consequences, despite wanting to stop.
Is this something that happens to us kind of over time, or are people like born and imagine you could look at the baby brain and like, yep, that person is going to be addicted to something? Like, are we born this way or do we become this way?
So, right, that's getting right at the core of nature versus nurture, which is at the heart of psychology, which we've been fighting about for as long as the field has existed. The answer is yes, right? So genetics are a huge portion. If you are the child of people with addictions, you are more likely to develop that, even if you were, you know, adopted at birth. But environment is a huge factor. So things happen along the way that make it more likely. And then personal decisions, as well as societal factors, you know, someone might have a predisposition developing an opioid addiction, but never really encounter opioids in daily life because they've never had an accident that left them needing pain medication. So yes, the genetic piece, the being born with the piece is there for some people. But whether or not that leads to addiction is completely based on environment. And there's some people that come from families with no history of addiction whatsoever that then, due to life circumstances, due to things that happen, end up developing one. So it's a little bit of both, and it varies from person to person.
So could it be like a situation for me, like I'll use myself as an example, I could be incredibly addicted to, let's use something benign, Nerds candy, but I've never had Nerds candy. And then one day it's just, boom, I'm off the rails.
In theory, yes, certainly could happen. There are, you know, documented cases of people that never had a problem with addiction in their life, get prescribed an opioid, and then it seems like they can never come off of it, right? So that sort of thing. So they get prescribed Oxy, and then it just never goes away. So that happens. I mean, that's less likely. More often than not, there's these complex factors, and it's not just one exposure. But there are cases that it is. It seems like that one exposure is enough, and it sets it all off.
Do people usually know it? Like, do they know that they're addicted, or do friends and family kind of spot it first?
Most, in my clinical work, most of the time, yes, they do. There tends to be an awareness. I mean, the consequences become severe enough that they realize they can't stop even when they want to, right? So often one of the criteria we look for in diagnosing an addiction is, well, have you tried to stop and fail? If you've tried to stop, you've typically acknowledged that something's wrong, right? And so there's an awareness that something's going on. Now, what's interesting is we actually see with certain behaviors, say viewing pornography or sexual behavior, people will say they have an addiction even when they don't have one. And so there's actually an over-reporting with some behaviors, and other behaviors are less likely to be reported. Like traditionally, people with an alcohol problem often take a little longer to realize it's a problem than, say, maybe someone that was dealing with an illicit drug problem. There's just like social norms and awareness might lead someone to really, I mean, the reality is that if you're using something like heroin that you're buying off the street, it doesn't take long to realize like, maybe this isn't the best and this is probably a sign that something's wrong. Whereas if you're, you know, having three drinks a day after work and that evolves into four, evolves into five, evolves into six, it may take longer for you to realize like, oh, wait a minute, this is a lot. This is a problem.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you specialize basically in gambling and sex addiction.
Those are the areas, yeah.
Are they fundamentally different than other types of addiction, or is addiction addiction? It's just instead of liking apples, you like oranges.
So the answer you get to that question is going to vary by the research professional you talk to. I'm definitely the one that says they are fundamentally different and functionally the same, which sounds like a weird distinction, and it is. In practice, with consequences in life, with how it affects your relationships, how it affects your work, how it affects your day-to-day living, they are functionally the same as most other addictions. You know, at the end of the day, an out-of-control behavior pattern that leads your relationships to fall apart, that leads you to get fired from jobs, that leads you to go into debt, that leads you to to do things that are maybe not legal to support it. Whether it's heroin or sex or gambling, they're all functionally looking the same. But fundamentally, I think when we really start parsing out what's going on underneath the surface in the brain and in the complex psychological processes leading to it, I think there are some differences. I'm of the opinion that there's maybe a difference between what we would call a compulsive behavior, which would be something like sex or gambling, and a true addiction, which we would say maybe is a substance that you've developed a dependence on. But that's very hotly debated. And so I would say this is my opinion as a scientist and a professional that works in this space, and that you could find five other scientists and professionals that I strongly respect that would absolutely disagree and say, no, they're exactly the same.
How prevalent, I guess, are gambling and sex addiction?
Like, so if we're talking about prevalence, so I'll answer gambling first because it's super straightforward. Somewhere between 0.5% and 5% of the population has problems with that. I tend to think the best numbers I think are in that 1-2% range. So given 100 people, one of them probably has a gambling problem. That is more common than, you know, pressing B on your keyboard, but far less common than alcohol, than nicotine, certainly less common than caffeine. It's the type that, again, if you think about your networks of people, you probably do know someone, whether you know that you know or not. You probably do know someone with a gambling problem. Whereas if you think of most of us, we think about our networks of people, we know several people that have substance use issues somewhere along the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Sex is a lot more complicated. And the reason being is that it's hard to determine what is a dysregulated amount of sex and whether or not someone's self-report is accurate. Here's what I mean by that. When we run nationally representative surveys and I ask, do you think you're addicted to porn? A full 10% of American men will say yes. That is an unbelievably high number. And I'm not trying to dismiss people's concerns, but if 10% of American men had a full-blown addiction, a true addiction to porn, we would expect there to be a much larger societal consequences. I mean, when we think about true addictions, we're talking about wages lost, work missed, relationships falling apart, health problems, all of these things. None of those things are currently attached to porn use. So we actually see this phenomena with porn in particular, where people will overreport it based on the fact that they're engaging in a behavior that makes them feel guilty and ashamed, but yet they still do it. And so there's this shame aspect with the sex stuff. And that really complicates it. If I guessed, I would say it's probably around that 1% mark, but I couldn't point to data that proved me right there.
That makes sense. I'll use like myself as an example, right? Like, I've certainly never missed work or anything like that, or, you know, like not spent time with family, but have I maybe looked at pictures when I probably should have been doing something else? Like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So is that kind of...
That's like part of it. I mean, the lion's share of this shame and guilt phenomena leading to someone thinking they have an addiction because they're feeling guilty is in more conservative, more religious groups. And so if you look in conservative religious groups in the U.S. And so I don't just so evangelical Christians are an obvious one here, but it's the same for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. It's the same for conservative Catholics. It's the same for several other denominations as well. It also occurs in the Orthodox Jewish community. There's an obsessive concern about how porn is ruining lives. And so there's a lot of messaging against pornography. So it's really heavily emphasized. You should never look at porn. Porn is bad. It's evil. It's a, I mean, there's verses in the Bible that people quote saying, like, you know, this is literally committing adultery. So when you're viewing porn, you're committing adultery on your spouse. And you get this messaging in people's head. And so they think, well, this is really bad, but yet I'm still viewing it once a month. I must have an addiction, because if it's this bad and I can't stop viewing it once a month, like, that means I'm addicted to it. And it's like, I mean, you viewed porn for 30 minutes last month, and like, yeah, it created a lot of distress for you, and it probably created drama in your relationships, but that's just not the criteria I typically associate with an addiction.
Yeah, that's kind of you and like, I would, okay, so when what point would you say if you looked at like, all right, now this is a problem, somebody,
right,
30 minutes a day?
Well, no, I mean, and so it's hugely variable, and it's going to vary on your kind of life circumstances and what's going on. What I would say is, are there objective consequences? So are you finding yourself, you know, viewing porn when you're at work and it's creating problems? So I don't mean like, okay, that one time 1 year ago I went to the bathroom with my phone. I mean like, no, at my desk. I mean every day. Or you find yourself spending multiple hours per day. So like, if you're in a situation where you're viewing porn for multiple hours a day, and it's getting in the way of work or relationships or self-care, like, hey, you haven't showered in 6 days because you've been spending 8 hours a day viewing porn. That's a bad sign. Like, that's not healthy, right? But we are looking for those more extreme cases. And what the more common presentation is, someone who might go 5 or 6 days a week without viewing, but then it's literally all weekend long, completely binged, not engaged in any relationships whatsoever, just almost every waking moment. And again, these are extreme examples, but those are the types of examples that we see in therapy that show up in some of the treatment studies as well, of people that it's objectively ruining their life. I mean, and that sounds like a weird criteria to put out there, but I mean, that's what it is. Is it actually really creating major problems in your life? Not your guilt about it, not your thoughts about it, but your actual behavior. Is that creating the problem? If the answer is it's the actual behavior, then that's a sign that something's going on that we probably want to work with.
It reminds me kind of like, I went to journalism school, so it comes from that, right? Like the definition of obscenity is like, I can't tell you what it is, but I know it as soon as I see it.
Yeah, it's a former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court that actually said that about obscenities and porn. We quoted it in some of our papers of like, defining porn is really hard. Defining obscenity is hard, but you know it when you see it. Addiction, I mean, there are, right, we use criteria like, you know, persistent patterns of dysregulation, but there's so much subjectivity in it. About what impairment looks like. So if you told me, well, you know, I'm an adult content creator, so I watch porn for 3 hours a day to get ideas, and I produce porn for 2 hours a day. Yeah, I actually enjoy that because that's who I am. I'm not going to tell that person that they have an addiction, even though they're spending 5 hours a day engaging with the porn, right? Because it's a different context. But the person that says, yeah, I'm spending, you know, a couple minutes here or there, but then I go on these 8 hour binges and like, I got fired for doing that at work, or I don't spend time with any of my friends anymore because every free moment I want to go do porn. That's a more concerning sign. It's easier with interpersonal sexual behavior. If you tell me like, yes, I'm constantly hooking up with strangers, having unsafe sex, I cannot stop no matter what I try. I've had 8 sexual partners last week. Don't remember who any of them were, and it was all unsafe and unprotected. I'm going to be concerned. Now, if you told me the same story and you're still being safe and protected, I'll be less concerned, actually. But again, there's this, when there's interpersonal sexual stuff, it's a little easier to pick up on than with, say, porn, because we all have individual private sexual behaviors that getting norms for are a little harder to establish.
I would imagine it's hard to get people to tell you the truth.
It is, but not for the reason that you think it is. So most people are like, oh, I bet you people lie because they don't want to share about their sex life. It's actually not typically that. It's the issue for getting the truth from people is that our own perceptions of our behavior shape what we see about ourselves. So you'll have people. We see this. It's actually pretty well documented with the people that game too much. So people that think they're addicted to games, if you actually measure how much time they're spending on games and then ask them how much time they spend on games, they will over-report. They'll pick numbers that are sometimes twice, three times as high as what they actually spent. So there's this feeling something's wrong, so they inflate it. And then the flip side, people thinking, no, nothing's wrong, and so they downplay it. And so our self-perception, and this is actually true of all addictions, you know, there's this notion sometimes in addiction therapy that, oh, you can't trust what your client says, they're going to lie to you. That's not what it is. Clients, people with addictions, people without addictions, we're not often very insightful about ourselves. And our worldviews, our beliefs, our behaviors, our relationships, what we had for breakfast that morning can all influence in that moment what we recall of our own behaviors. And it changes what we say to the people in front of us. So, yeah, it's hard to get honest reports, but I tell when I'm training new therapists, I tell them, you're not interested with therapy is not always about the objective truth. It's about their experience of their lives and getting to an experience of their life that's more positive, that's more, that works for them. And so maybe that what they're telling you isn't entirely accurate, but it is what they think is accurate. So
is that because are they in any way kind of, I don't know what the right phrase is, self-deflecting? Like they're not, they know what the truth is, but they won't admit it, or just that we as a people are just bad at this?
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes people are trying to hide and self-deflecting and are being dishonest with themselves. I couldn't put a proportion on it, but I would say I think it's probably more common that we just kind of lack insight. There are points in therapy as a therapist where I'm trying to push a client to say, okay, if we really do an honest inventory of ourselves right now, I think you're going to come up with a different answer. But more often than not, it's, you know, about reframing what's going on so that they can arrive. So it's not challenging them to be honest with themselves. It's challenging them to think about it differently, which will then lead to a different conclusion, which sounds like a small difference, but it is actually a pretty dramatic difference in the room with how we're approaching things.
So when you look at like sex addiction, is it more prevalent amongst men, women?
Undoubtedly, men. Among people that self-identify as having sex addiction, that seek treatment from sex addiction, men are more common, and typically it's heterosexual men. Despite the fact that bisexual, gay men who have sex with men are actually typically much more sexually active and having more sexual encounters in their daily lives. It's typically heterosexual men that are identifying as having a sex addiction.
How come? Why is that? Why would that be? Would it be?
So there's huge, huge, huge number of variables that go into play. One of the big ones is that same thing I was talking about with morality and shame and guilt and beliefs. Disproportionately, the men who are dealing with conservative sexual values and feeling like they're violating are going to be men that identify as heterosexual, right? If you're in a conservative religious group that says that viewing porn is evil, chances are you're also in a conservative religious group that says being anything other than heterosexual is evil. So part of it is they're heterosexual by identification because that's all they're allowed to. So that's one factor. I mean, another factor is what's normative. There are, you know, basic differences in sexual frequency, desire, drive between men and women. I mean, it's very complex, and I don't want to get into like gender binary debates and all of that kind of stuff.
No.
Broadly speaking, on the whole, women are less likely to desire the frequency of sexual encounters as men. There's societal reasons for that. Whether or not they're biological is a separate debate. And so heterosexual men are less likely to have partners that want sex as frequently as they are. And so there's a mismatch of desire. So one of the most common things you see in heterosexual marriages is desire mismatch, right? Where man wants more sex than woman And instead of, you know, working this throughout with compromise or therapy or conversations, man turns to porn, and then he feels like he's viewing porn all the time, and it turns into this vicious cycle of, I'm not getting the sex I want, so I'm viewing porn, but I can't stop viewing porn. And when I try to stop viewing porn, I couldn't. Therefore, I haven't. And it just gets this kind of spiral effect where these, again, all of these things, like it's hard to talk about it like casually because there's so many different individual and then cultural variables that come into play. And I can imagine a counterpoint for everything that I'm saying. But on the whole, we see heterosexual men reporting it more, and it seems to be a combination of desire mismatch leading to other behaviors and then the conservative sexual values.
For gambling addictions, mm-hmm. right? Like, is it, I guess, what are they addicted to?
So it there's variability depending on the game of preference. In some case, some studies actually indicate it's an addiction to the ambiguity and the chance aspect of it. So what we actually have seen in repeated neurological studies and in Curie activity studies, they're just different paradigms that we use. People seem to be more attached not to the win, but to that moment right before where they know whether it's a win or a near miss. So imagine on a traditional, so slots are really complicated. Imagine on a more traditional slot setup, you've got your 3, 4, 7, whatever it is, rows, you know, spinning, right? And they hit in order, and whether it's a digital slot or the old school traditional ones, they don't all stop at the same time. They stop one by one. So there's this build of like, all right, I got this one logo showed up, this one fruit in the old school slot machines. And the second one just hit the same. And there's this building anticipation, like, ooh, what's going to be next? And then the third one hits just the same, and you're just waiting on that fourth one. And in that brief moment, there's this heightening of, I mean, everything inside, like adrenaline kind of starts to pump. There's a lot of other kind of neurochemicals getting involved, bringing your attention into this moment, really tying you into what's about to hit next. What's going to be that last one? And what we find is that the arousal level actually hits the hardest when you get, you know, 3, 4, whatever it is in a row, and the last one misses than when the last one hits. There's that near miss phenomena where there's this rush, and then the crushing disappointment, and that emotional roller coaster produces reactions in people that we crave at an almost subconscious level. Now, yes, everyone loves winning, but if you won every time, it wouldn't be gambling, right? Like, that's, people aren't, so workaholism is not an actual addiction, right? You aren't addicted to going to work and making sure you get that paycheck every time. Like, that's not a thing. It's the uncertainty piece that seems to activate something. Now, there's theories about this. A lot of people go back to evolutionary psychology and say that we're wired to seek uncertainty because uncertainty has the chance of better payoffs. I'm not entirely convinced by that argument, but there is something to be said for humans like uncertainty, even when we say that we don't. We like a little bit of ambiguity. We like surprises. And it seems to be that same process there. And that's for slot. I mean, it gets more complicated when we're talking about sports and cards and things like that. But they all seem to be that same piece of that uncertainty, that moment of uncertainty. It's not when you win that hooks you. It's that uncertainty that you keep coming back for.
I would have never thought it that way, right? Like, I would have thought that they were addicted to the sensation of winning, but it sounds like they're really addicted to the sensation of almost winning and then losing.
Right. And if you talk to most gamblers,
boom, boom.
Yeah, if you talk to most gamblers, they'll be like, but no, it's the winning. And at a conscious level, it is the winning. But when we look at what's happening underneath the surface, it is that bump, bump roller coaster of that almost hitting it and then dropping. And then that makes the win even that much sweeter, right? Because you've gotten that ride the roller coaster up and drop, ride the roller coaster, and then finally it hits and it's like, yes. But again, it is that it's all built on the losses. Like, you have to have the losses for the wins to be appealing.
Does it matter the game? Like, is there a difference between the person who's addicted to blackjack versus craps versus poker versus slot machines?
So blackjacks versus craps versus poker, actually, most often there's not a whole lot of differences going on there. I joked that the difference between someone who has an addiction to poker and then someone who's on the World Poker Tour is well, how good they are, right? It's not that addiction isn't quite the same as what we're seeing with slots in particular. And the reason being, skill-based games, craps is kind of more chance. So blackjack and poker have more skill pieces, poker being one of the most skill-based games with some chance interjected into it. And then everything gets progressively more chance-based. Those type of people that develop those problems, it's typically a complicated picture based less on the inherently appealing nature of the game and more on what they're using the game to mean for themselves. Slots, in practice, you see more people addicted to slots, to sports betting, to keno, in more rare cases, like extreme lottery ticket buying, things like that. But for those people, there's often this clear use of the gambling as a detachment from something else going on. So we've documented this in a lot of our research, that people with PTSD in particular are really drawn to slot machines, to games that are very kind of zone out and just bring yourself into the game. So, I mean, you could develop a slot machine problem without PTSD, but oftentimes we see the slots functioning as a way of shutting out the rest of the world, shutting off your internal world, and just being in tune with this one emotional roller coaster and not the rest of your life. It's chaos. Where that's a less common presentation for poker, things like that.
Are you ready for some harder/listener-submitted questions?
I'm always for some listener-submitted questions.
Can people really break the cycle, or do they just change one addiction for another?
People can absolutely break the cycle, and I would challenge people to think that breaking the cycle doesn't just mean total abstinence. You know, if someone in college was drinking 6-7 drinks a day, living in a perpetual state of hungover to drunk, and couldn't stop when they wanted, but then come to a point through either intervention or personal decision that they drink once or twice a month, that's breaking the cycle, right? That's breaking a cycle of what looks like an addictive behavior, even if they're not abstinence, even if they've chosen to do things in a way that's safe. There's this notion in addiction treatment of harm reduction. Anything you do that makes you safer and more likely to wake up tomorrow, even in the midst of your addiction, that's breaking part of the cycle. And so, yes, absolutely. And I see people that go through recovery for one substance and never pick another one up. And yes, I see people the other way too, that just seem to transfer one to the other. The person that had alcohol that goes to gambling, from gambling goes to sex, from sex they go to heroin. Like, yes, you see that. But more often than not, I see people that break the cycle or get to a safer place, and they don't go back to that dark place again, and they move forward.
What's that like? I guess then, what's the secret in the therapy, or what's their secret? Like, what did?
I don't think there's anything as far as, I don't think it's a secret. I think it's a combination of, you know, getting the type of therapy you need. But a lot of people actually naturally remit, which is hard for therapists to admit. But it's over half of people that have addictions that recover without therapists whatsoever. Like, they just, for some people, it is absolute just white knuckling it through it. Other people, their lives change. A relationship ends that was dragging them down. For other people, it's a series of gradual changes. Like, I've met more than, you know, I know lots of people that, you know, cold turkeyed their way quitting smoking, but I know a lot of other people that was like, well, I used to smoke 2 packs a day, and then it came down to a half a pack a day, and then I switched to a vape. And I've been on a vape for 3 years now, but I only vape, you know, twice a day. And yes, they're still, you know, dealing with the nicotine, but like, they're also, their lung cancer risk went way down, all of those types. So like, it's all sorts of different pictures that I see. And so it's not one size fits all. And one of the things, if someone's listening to this and is really struggling with addiction, they don't feel like they can get through, my only advice is keep trying. And if something's not working, don't just keep trying that. Like, if you've been trying to go to AA meetings for 10 years and it's never worked, try something different. Like, AA doesn't work for everybody. Works for a lot of people, doesn't work for everybody. So try something different.
Which does society demonize more, gambling or sex addiction?
Sex. Yeah, sex, undoubtedly. It's because our society has got such a still such a strong kind of Protestant background. And if you look even politically, you know, one of the major political parties in the country is very strongly aligned with conservative Christian sexual values. So right now it's sex. Was it that way 50 years ago? I don't know. Will it be that way 50 years from now? I don't know. Right now, though, I'd say it's sex.
Are we more addicted now than you think that we were in the past?
No. This is actually a pretty common idea. Like, oh, no, thanks to technology and hyper-palatable foods, we're all developing more addiction than before. I don't think there's any good evidence of that. I think addictions have been here with us. The reason we think that there's more now is that we're more aware of what's happening. We just get better at measuring what's around us the longer we go. I think a good analogy is if you look at sports and sports statistics. And so you might sometimes listen to an old sports fan, like, back in my day, we didn't have all these statistics. It's like, I mean, but they were there. Like, these metrics were still happening, but right, no one was right. Measuring it, right? So, like, you'll see anytime you watch an NBA game, this is the first time someone's gone for this many minutes at this many scores at this many thing while wearing shorts that were this long or whatever, right? Like, and it seems absurd, but, like, it's measurement. We're better at measuring things now than we used to be.
This is completely aside, but the thing that I always wonder about is, like, what did people in, like, the 1800s, they just look at clouds that look like a woman? Like, what were they doing?
I mean, history of porn is one of the really, I mean, I'm not a historian, but I've read some of this work. You know, there's certainly evidence that people were marketing erotic drawings hundreds and hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. It took only just a few short years from the invention of the camera to the selling of, you know, nudes. The reason that Blu-ray won out over, what was it, HD disc or whatever it was because
I heard that about. Yeah, right? Porn industry Betamax.
Betamax is for what. And this is consistent. Like, we have always used the technology at our disposal to produce images of sexuality, whether that was drawing on paper to now with full-blown virtual reality.
Are we all addicted to something?
So I think if you think of addiction in terms of functional impairment, like, is this behavior creating problems in your ability to exist in life? The answer is no. If we're thinking about addiction in terms of, is this something I can't stop even if I wanted to? Then yes, right? So, like, yes, I'm absolutely addicted to caffeine. Like, I traveled abroad a couple of years ago before COVID to a country that did not have easy access to coffee, and I had withdrawal headaches for 2 days until I finally found a Starbucks. It was 16 blocks from my hotel, and I walked to it every single day from there on out to get coffee. That absolutely sounds like an addiction when you describe it. Functionally, right now at home, three kids and wife at home, I get up in the morning, I make coffee, and I don't have problems. And so, like, is that an addiction, a true addiction? Probably not. But in a different set of circumstances, could it be seen as one? Probably.
This one's a little lighthearted. Where on the scale of addiction studies are you? Like, is the gambling and sex addiction person cooler than the person who studies, like, addiction to eating salt or addiction to something else? Like,
right. So, I mean, I think that depends on who you ask. Depends on how you define cool. Right now, if you want to talk about being able to get grant money and who's able to get the money to do the work they want, then we're the bottom of the totem pole. But if you want to talk about the ones that people are the most excited to talk to and interested in, I think that we get a lot of public interest because the public's interested in these things, even if the funding agencies aren't.
Yeah. They can't really fund it as much, I guess.
Historically not. Gambling's getting there. Eventually sex might, but sex, it just gets so wrapped up in the politics of it all, right? So
that kind of a question that just jumps into my head is, right, like, so what do you think about gambling? Was hush hush, no gambling, only in Vegas. Now you see advertisements for it left and right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess, what do you think about that? Is this a new wave is coming, or, like, what do you?
So I see, you know, sometimes you see people that are very pro gambling saying there's not going to be any problems. It's just a new economic activity. And then sometimes you'll see people that are in the anti-gambling community say, this is going to completely restructure society as we know it. And I think both are completely wrong. I think of it in terms of, if you think about people being predisposed to developing a problem with addiction, and then I mentioned really early on in this kind of podcast that, well, sometimes you might be predisposed but are never exposed to it, right? So you might be predisposed to develop an alcohol problem, but for whatever reason, you just chose to never drink in your life. And you never drank, so you never knew that you were predisposed because you were never exposed to it. I think gambling is going to be like that. I think more people that would have never developed a problem will, but I don't think we're talking about some massive epidemic. I think we're talking, if the prevalence rate is 1% now, maybe the prevalence rate goes to 2% now. That's an absolute doubling in the number of people that have gambling addictions, which is a very big deal. But it's also not like some rampant disease wrecking all of society. And so it's this kind of nuanced view. But I do think more people will develop problems that don't have it. And I think it won't be as bad as some people are afraid that it is. You know, I am concerned, especially with the fact that a lot of states are legalizing the ability to gamble from your phone. The privacy aspect of it scares me a little bit. It's easier to be responsible with your bets when you know people are watching you. But if nobody's watching you and it's not real money and there's not chips on a table, it's just numbers on a screen, I'm concerned, but it's a cautious concern, not a... I don't necessarily believe that it's definitely going to be a huge problem. I want to see what happens. And that's what a lot of our research now is just documenting trends over time.
Most interesting gambling case, most interesting sex addiction case you've had.
So I can't talk about specific client details publicly, right, because of HIPAA and Fair Fellow Protections. I think though some of my most gambling cases are the ones that have won big. And I don't mean like, oh, they won 5,000 or 10,000. Like I have cases that have won 1 or 2 million, either via lottery or via some just insane casino payoff, and then lost it all. It says something to say I was up $2 million at one point, and now I'm in the hole 500,000. I mean, that speaks to what's going on. That's that. And then sex addiction. It's not actually the sex addiction cases that are the most interesting to me. It's the ones that think they have a sex addiction when they don't. So, like, talking to someone that might say, I'm addicted to porn. I'm like, okay, so when was the last time you viewed porn? Well, you know, 3 weeks ago when I was in the supermarket, I was at the impulse counter and I saw this very scantily clad woman on the magazine and I thought of what she might look like naked. And you're like, yeah, but when was the last time you looked at porn? And that's what they meant. And it's like this completely warped view of the world based on just complete concerns about, you know, not looking at a woman with lust in your eyes, which is, you know, a thing that comes up in Christian faith a lot. And like, so that's fascinating to me. Again, not a true addiction, but a fascinating worldview to kind of work with in the therapeutic room. Very hard. Doesn't actually work out very well sometimes, but very, very interesting.
Yeah. Like what do you do in that kind of circumstances when you maybe somebody thinks they have an addiction, but it's not really an addiction.
Right. Well, if someone is coming to me and asking for help, then I believe that they're a person that's in front of me that needs help. And so sometimes the help is addiction treatment because you have addiction related kind of behaviors. But sometimes that's something like the term we use is acceptance and commitment therapy. It's kind of a school of thought, a type of therapy that's focused more on learning to not get so caught up in the struggles. Basically being able to say, I fell short of my goals. That is in the past. I am moving forward. And so I'm not saying I don't try to tell, you know, if my client's a conservative Christian, I'm not going to say, well, first you should be an atheist and then you should be okay viewing porn. Like, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say, okay, what are your values? How do we live up to those values without causing suffering in your life? And what does that mean for you? And so it looks a little different for everyone, but oftentimes it's about learning not to hate yourself when you fall short of your values and learning not to obsess about those values when you're living up to. And so it's this balance of trying to just kind of even things out.
Do people, like, when they cure the addiction, but can they ever get over a sense of shame? Like that, oh, I was a gambler and I lost $10 million or whatever and I don't gamble anymore. But then do they ever get over that? The aspect
oftentimes
that they were?
The negative emotion around it goes, the shame goes. So there'll still be some regret, right? Feeling like I wish it hadn't been. But it doesn't carry the same pain. And a part of that is if you think about a lot of recovery groups, so whether it's AA or GA or 12-step groups, or there's lots of other groups that aren't 12 steps, that are different patterns, they're built on you telling your story pretty often. And the more often you tell a story, it's the same thing for PTSD, actually. The more often you tell that story that causes you pain, the less pain it causes, because you just get used to telling the story. It doesn't mean that you couldn't find the pain if you wanted to. It doesn't mean that there's not still some emotion there, because of course there is. But it becomes less painful because it's just your story at that point. And the bigger thing we deal with is when somebody has an incident where they slip back into something, there's often crushing shame. And then that crushing shame is like, well, what's the point in anything? Might as well keep going. And it's like, no, a incident, you know, you've been sober for 10 years and you had one drink. That doesn't mean you need to give up and have 10 drinks a day for the rest of your life. It just means you had one drink, you slipped up, time to get back on.
I always wondered if John Daly was like a good example or a bad example. Of somebody that was addicted and really had some trouble with it, stopped for a long time, and then just seems to have become okay with it, like in control, but still doing the thing that he was addicted to.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I hesitate to point out like exemplars like of somebody that is but like I do think, like I said earlier, whatever you're doing that makes it more likely that you wake up tomorrow morning and that the people around you aren't getting harmed by what you're doing is a step in the right direction. And so if the thing is, if you know, like, I'm going to end up using and I cannot stop it, but you learn a way to do that that doesn't put your life in extreme risk and isn't actively hurting the people around you, I tend to think of that as, I mean, good versus bad is one way of thinking about it. I think of that as a better direction to go than just going full bore, you know.
Is it always bad?
Addiction?
Is addiction always bad?
It depends on how you define bad. I think of addiction oftentimes as a reaction to what life's got going on. So sometimes people turn to addictions because what's going on in their life is so bad that they don't feel like they can face it without it. And I've worked with people with addictions that will say, well, if I hadn't had that substance, I would have just committed suicide. And in that situation, it's a hard thing to say that was bad. It may not have been the best thing for them, but it's hard to say it was bad if they think that kept them alive. I've heard that phrase before, and I think that's one aspect. I mean, the other aspect of it is, as humans, we're always balancing enjoying life and accomplishing the things that need to be accomplished. And it's not inherently bad that sometimes that balance gets out of whack, where we get a little too far on the enjoyment side of things, and we need to pull it back. We need to rein it back in. Like, I mean, so, again, I don't think I would say it's always bad. Yes, we want people to be safe. But sometimes people are going to engage in substances. They're going to engage in behaviors. Sometimes they're going to get a little bit out of control. And it doesn't have to be the world.
I would imagine that that's true in the sense that, like, people don't get addicted to something for no reason. Like, are they usually kind of using it to compensate for something that might have been the worse option?
Oftentimes that is the case, yes. I mean, there are pure physiological addictions, if you will. There are these moments where people purely just develop a dependence on something and they can't stop because they're dependent on them. More often than not, yes, it is the addiction developed because the other options seemed worse. Now, we can debate on the outside whether it was or was not, but for the person living it, that's what it felt like for them. And that's, I mean, for me, that's part of being a non-judgmental therapist, is realizing that what led them to this point is not just some deranged, you know, desire to have an addiction or just lack of self-control or being weak. No, what led them to this point was a set of options that said, no, this is the option that makes the most sense for me. And if we can understand that, a lot of times addiction therapy is about making sure that there's better options there so that addiction's no longer the best option.
Yeah. Kind of like I can confront my childhood filled with abuse, or I can drink alcohol.
Yeah.
Like, well, and I'd drink alcohol is what I would do.
Right. And that happens. And there may come a point where, with the right supports in place, where confronting that abuse makes more sense. But where you are for whatever reason right now, it just doesn't. And so you choose to avoid it via substances.
That's pretty much all the questions we got, man. Is there anything that you think we missed, or
no?
How can people kind of learn more about you? And
yeah, if you're ever interested in learning more about me, you can always find me. I'm on Twitter at Joshua Grubbs PhD. My website is joshuagrubsphd.com. Both of those are probably the best ways to kind of catch up with me. But I'm always happy to hear from folks if people have questions. You know, I do get a lot of emails. I can't promise I'll respond to everything, but I do try. And again, I'm pretty active on social media as well.
What's the most addictive thing that you think? Like, ooh, man, people get into that and it is just tough.
I was going to say caffeine. No, it's not caffeine. Right now, I'm trying to decide if I think this is objectively true or if it's just because of where we kind of are societally. I mean, I tend to think opioids is pretty darn. So like the heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil, that kind of isolate, which all have their purposes medically. But any human being, if you gave them a daily dose of an opioid, for 2 weeks, they will be dependent on it at the end of the 2 weeks. Now, some people will fight through the withdrawals, but it's a very easy addiction to create. I think it's the easiest addiction to create that we've seen.
I want to thank Dr. Grubb so much for joining us. If you want to connect with him, we have linked to him on our social media accounts. We're Profoundly Pointless on Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram, and we have also included his information in the episode description. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, he has some great resources that are available to help you out. So real quick, I want to tell you about a new podcast that we discovered. It's called Too Much Information. It's an iHeartRadio podcast that gives you the secret history and behind the scene details about your favorite movies, music, TV shows, and more.
Too Much Information is a new podcast that gives you the secret histories and little known facts about your favorite movies, music, TV shows, and more.
It's brought to you by two trivia titans with too much free time. I'm Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Runtog. We're pop culture buffs and listicle writers who've worked at national magazines, TV networks, and New York newspapers.
Now we're leaving the lists and diving deep into a different beloved entertainment classic 3 times a week.
Get ready for everything you never knew about Ocean's 11, ABBA's Dancing Queen, Hook.
The list goes on.
Listen and follow Too Much Information wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Okay, now let's bring in John Shull and get to the pointless part of the show with a new candle of the month. I had some questions that I was going to ask you, but instead, whenever we do one of these beginning of the month episodes, are you just basically ignoring everything that I say until you can get to candle of the month?
I am pretty excited about this month's. I mean, I'm always excited, but I did some extra research on this one, and I haven't actually bought it yet, but it was recommended to me by two people. So that's good enough for me, so I'm going to throw it out
there. Wait a minute. You're going to say, you're going to put forward to the people as your candle of the month, a candle that you have not actually used? You're going to stake your reputation on somebody else's word.
I am. I trust their candle connoisseurship.
Do you have a planner that you write stuff in?
Like to keep track of the candles that I talk
no,
about?
No, just like in general. Like, are you a planner person? Like, I'm going to write this down in my calendar.
I'm just finding that the older I get, the less I remember. So I'm almost thinking about like starting a diary.
I think men have to call it a journal.
Okay. A journal then, not a diary.
Right. Like I couldn't tell another man that like, hey man, I got a diary, but I could be like, oh yeah, I have a journal.
I you can call it whatever you want. I think I just need to start remembering. Plus I kind of want to just remember the days. Like, do you even remember what you were like in February? What you were doing, what you were watching, what your interests were?
No. But that probably means it really wasn't that important to you at the same time, right? I do keep, I call it a memory of a day journal. I'm actually going to class it up and I'm going to go all the way to memoir. But I keep it and I write down memories. I've never actually looked back through it, though.
How long have you been doing it for?
Oh, it might be 10 years.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, that's not the answer you thought. You thought you were going to get hit with like 6 months or like a year, but no, I hit you with like, hey man, I've been doing it.
I actually thought you were going to turn it into a my mom joke. I didn't know you were being serious.
No, I mean, I've been doing it for 10 years, but I've been doing your mom for 20.
Oh man.
What do you think the first entry in my memoir is going to be? man, that was good. Better than the last 30 times.
What do you think your first chapter of your memoir would actually be like?
Ooh. I think you'd have to be the basic theme of your life. Whatever the basic theme of your life would be. Like, what do you think is the basic theme of your life? Like, the overall character arc of John Shull.
That he's a good person.
You are actually a good person. I would have to give that. Like,
I envision, like, the first chapter being told from another person's perspective about how I impacted their life. That's how I would envision mine.
So then, autobiography is when you write it. A biography is when someone else writes it. I always get those confused. I feel like there's a third one that's like a dual, by I was told to, or something like that. Anyway, nobody's that interested in that. Okay, do you think that your perception of yourself is the same way that other people see you? Or would you be surprised to hear how people around you would describe you?
Yeah, I would be absolutely surprised. And I say that because I think just as people, we don't value ourselves very much. Like, for all I know, I could be the best part of a dozen people's days. Just me being at work or whatever, or waking up next to my wife.
Or the worst.
That's a lie. Or the worst.
Do you know for a fact if there are people out there that can't stand you?
For a fact, no.
You're with 90% plus confidence. Like, I'm pretty sure this person hates me.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, well, no. Yeah, there's... What's funny is that it's probably the people that you would think are actually supposed to be the closest to you that I would think oftentimes hate you the most.
Oh, you mean like people that you have to associate with a lot? Yeah, I think you really have to kind of be in consistent contact with somebody to truly dislike them.
Yeah, I would say probably the max of two people that probably legitimately hate me.
I can think of one for sure that hates me. I can't think of a second. I'm probably like on the list of a couple of people, but not
every time in life that anyone's ever said something like that to me. You remember Billy Madison?
Not personally. I remember the movie.
Oh, well, I forget his name. Steve Buscemi. He's like a serial killer, and he has a list of people that he wants to tick off. And Billy Madison's on there. But then Billy goes and apologizes to him for making fun of him. And he crosses his name off the list. That's what, you know, that's what I envisioned when you just said, I'm probably on a few people's list. They're just getting to me.
I can think of one definitely for sure, but I can't think of that many others. On the topic of our guest that we had this week, though, have you ever been addicted to anything?
Yeah, I'm addicted to everything. I have an addictive personality. I can't just do something. Like, for instance, the best example, it just happened to me. My dog pulled down one of my curtain rods out of the wall. So obviously you have to put it back in, you have to anchor it, whatever. But instead of just doing one, I went around and checked every curtain rod. And the ones that were kind of, you know, fugly, I redid.
I think that's obsessive compulsive. I don't think that's addicted. Like, you're not addicted to reinstalling curtain rods. I think that's obsessive compulsive.
I mean, alcohol, gambling, fun times.
It's tough. That's what's difficult, is that so much of what is fun in life is kind of bad for you.
Which is shitty if you really think about it.
I wonder, though, if it wasn't bad for you, if it would still be fun. Kind of bad for you, right? Like, alcohol, we could have this debate, right? Like, it's pretty obvious, like, hey, you know what? You probably shouldn't do heroin. I don't think that there's any positive health benefits for heroin. But people understand what we're talking about, right? Like, alcohol, not the worst thing that you can do. But what if it was, like, drinking water? And it was like, hey, would it still be as fun?
Well, that's the thing. Some people are addicted to that, right? Like, look at The Rock. You could say he's addicted to self fitness or whatever.
No, I think it's
physical fitness.
Steroids is what it is, really.
Well, I mean, whatever. Yeah, but I would go on a limb and say that addictions are 90% bad to 10% good. I'll say 96% bad to 4% good.
Well, I would think that pretty much being addicted to anything where it's like impacting your life, the definition of addicting is probably almost 100%. But I know what you mean, right? Like it's usually nobody's – well, people can be addicted to exercise.
Yeah, like if you're addicted to whatever, eating vegetables, that's not a bad addiction. I mean, you're going to have some pretty smelly-ass farts for a while, but it's not terrible. I will say we don't need to get into addiction, but it's a serious thing. And it definitely can lead you down some paths you don't want to be on.
Yeah, we're probably not really qualified to be talking about this.
Well, I mean, you're talking to a guy who has had to regrow his liver twice. So I'm not necessarily qualified, but I've been down some dark roads. I think we all have.
Yeah, I can't say that I've ever really struggled with something that I've wanted to stop doing and not been able to. But that does, it's interesting what you talked about is like you might have something, you just haven't discovered it yet. Like it could be like, who knows in the future, right? It could happen at any moment. We should probably just move on. All right, are you ready for your shout outs?
I am. Hold on. Let me bring them up first.
So you're not all right, ready. Here. Not ready would be the answer there.
I was expecting to go down a rabbit hole on the whole addiction thing.
Yeah, but I feel we don't know what we're talking about. We should probably just bail out on that one.
Well, that would be this entire 4-year podcast. All right. Let's see here. We'll start with Holden McElroy, Johnny Stone, Phoenix Lethal, Thomas.
This can't be real. Okay, but this is just Phoenix.
Thomas Raymond, Joe Sheehy. Rico Wee, PJ O'Reilly, LeVar German, and Charlie Mason. You all get the shout outs for the day. Congratulations.
I will never get tired of the way that you do these. Like you've never seen the word before. Like to hook.
It's kind of embarrassing.
The
I think people like don't want me to say their name so they don't follow us on purpose. That's probably a smarter play. Also, what's up with your sign back there? It's looking a little mangy.
That's the point of the profoundly pointless sign. Like other people have fancy studios. We have a piece of notebook paper where we wrote profoundly pointless on it and then hung it to the wall with duct tape, which has since been marked up by two children and chewed on by a dog.
I was going to say, are those teeth marks?
Those teeth what marks is by the dog.
Huh.
Still the original sign, though. Holding on for dear life back there.
Man. Well, once I get my studio back, which, you know, update on my basement, it's only half fucked up, but it should be done before Christmas. So it's only been 5 months in the making, but here we are.
Christmas of this year or Christmas 2023?
Christmas of this year.
Okay, so that means summer of 2023.
Yeah, well, the rising costs and everything makes you never makes me want to quit
here
now.
Here we go. Okay.
You want to hear some bullshit? Let me tell you some bullshit here real fast. I got to say one
thing. This is the problem. Right? This is why people start to dislike old. This is why younger people start to dislike people in their 30s as they get older in their 40s. Because everything becomes about the conversations about their house or their children.
Listen, I just want to say this, and then we can move on.
How long before, in any conversation you would have with somebody, how long before either the house, the children, or the weather comes up? 30 seconds? A minute? How long before it's one of those three things gets brought up in any conversation you have with somebody?
It's probably one of the first sentences, probably within the first 30 seconds.
Right. This is what's happening.
Anyways, what my point is, I know I'm getting old because go to Ohio this weekend. I live in Michigan. Went to Ohio to see mother-in-law.
How is Big Deb? Does she listen to this podcast? Can I say Big Deb? Try not to say Big Deb.
Paid $4.20 a gallon of gas here in Michigan.
Ooh, that's cheap.
I don't know what it is in Seattle.
It's $6.
drive 60 miles to the Ohio border. It's $3.59. How is it 60 cents more a gallon 60 miles away? Or 60 cents less a gallon 60 miles away?
Well,
I almost crashed my car into the gas station. I was so floored.
Well, wait a minute. Did you buy gas the first time in Detroit and then left the metro area and went more into the countryside? Because there's your answer right there.
Well, I mean, we were near Toledo. I mean, it's not
Toledo and
metropolis,
Detroit,
but,
right? Okay,
but it was $3.50, $3.60, $3.79 everywhere in Ohio.
I think gas is always generally cheaper in the Midwest and away from bigger cities.
Stupid! It's stupid. Anyways, that's my rant. That's all. You know, I'm not going to even get into the car drama I had this past week.
Hear it. Because it's your fault. Yeah. And we know it's your fault. So let's just move to the point where we realize it's your fault. And can we go?
It's fine.
Right? The candle's burning here.
Yeah, let's go. All right. Got a couple of bangers for you. Crushed ice, cubed ice, or ball ice. What's your favorite kind of ice cube?
I'm never the kind of person that likes ball ice. That is too fancy for me. Give me cubed if I'm having some sort of a drink that is in a glass. But if it is a plastic cup, then I'm going to go crushed ice.
Okay. All right. I'm always going cubed ice. And then ball ice is nice. Kind of fancy. Crushed ice is probably my least favorite. So,
but if you have a drink, this is what I would say is the hard and fast rule. If you have a drink in a plastic cup that is 32 ounces or more, you have to go with crushed ice. Especially if it's carbonated.
I guess I'm trying to think back. I don't even remember the last time I had a 32 ounce drink.
Okay.
What are you getting? A big gulp?
Yeah, dude, get a big gulp. Big gulp. If it is a big gulp, and the definition of a big gulp is 32 ounces or more up to a 64, then you got to go with crushed ice. Can you think about how much liquid 64 ounces of something is? Like, that should be – I'm not going into this whole thing about, like, sugar taxes and all that kind of stuff. But 64 yes. ounces of a drink, like, that is kind of ridiculous. I need 2 liters of this right now on my desk. Is a little bit like 64 ounces of Mountain Dew. All right, let's pump the brakes on that a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, also there's been studies that like it's really like 20 ounces of actual pop. The rest is carbonated water or water. So really, you're just getting crap.
Yeah, but still, I mean, 64 ounces is a lot. It's a lot of liquid. Right? Nobody's drinking 64 ounces of water, I'll tell you that.
They're not the unhealthy bastards.
I don't think I've had water in a week. I can go a week without drinking just straight water.
So what are you drinking?
Basically a combination of like pop or chocolate milk.
How are you a grown-ass man?
Crystal Light, Fruit Punch. Not very well, man. It's not going well.
All right, second question here. Would you rather have fugly toes or fugly fingers or fugly teeth?
Oh, fugly toes, man. You got to go with the thing that people see the least, right? So you go toes. Oh, man. Toes, then fingers, then teeth.
But I feel like when people see your toes and if they're fugly, that's they remember that.
When have you ever looked at another man's toes?
I mean, I I'm weird, so I kind of make it a habit to look at people's toes. But
what? What the? Like, is that your jam? If that's your jam, actually, that actually makes more sense if that's like your jam. But if you're just like randomly looking at people's feet, it makes no sense.
I wasn't randomly looking at people's feet, but if you know, if you're at the beach or at a water park or something, my eyes just kind of always gravitate towards their feet, the people's feet for some reason.
Okay, so that I feel like that happens only one of two reasons, right? Either because you're self-conscious of yours and you want to see what other people's look like and comparatively, or you think yours are really good and you want to compare yours to other people and be like, that guy may be 6'3", 250, ripped out and have a huge package, but his toes suck.
I think I have pretty exquisite toes. I'm not going to lie to you.
Okay, now we've identified that source of But I have fantastic calves, and I don't look at people's calves. Actually, I do now that I think about it.
I think it's just human. Like, we think we have something that's superior, so then we look at everyone else's that isn't.
You gotta validate yourself. I got you. Okay.
All right. We'll knock this one off quick here. So on our Ask People to Vote Twitter poll.
So when other people get to contribute to the show, we're going to get that one out of the way fast so you can get to your candle of the month. That is rude.
Why are you? Come on,
you're
man.
The one that said it. I didn't. I respect the people. The people voted on this, and they want to hear what we're going to say about it, and you just dismiss it so you can talk about your candles.
Oh, man, you...
You got nothing on that.
I got nothing. All right, so let's talk. So obviously there's cheating all over the place, every profession, everywhere. Sports, life, Wall Street, it doesn't matter. But could you imagine cheating at a walleye fish tournament? Could you imagine getting caught stuffing fish with lead weights and other little fishes to try to make your fish heavier to win? And then... imagine the fallout from all your angry fishermen when they find out that you were trying to cheat.
Yeah, I mean, I can. That sounds like, I mean, is there money involved? Because then, yeah.
Yeah, it was, I believe there it was a prize of almost $30,000. That this,
I don't know why people aren't cheating. What is the least amount of money that you would cheat for? The prize is this. I'm still going to cheat.
Well, okay, so like, what would happen if I got caught? Just return the money, or would I go to jail?
No, just immoral, not illegal.
Oh, $1,000? $500?
Oh, I'd cheat for $100, honestly.
Yeah, I mean...
maybe even 20 if there's not a lot of people involved.
I mean, yeah, $100 can buy you still. It can still buy you some things. So
now that I think about it, I play the game Sorry with my children who are 6 and 3, and I cheat to win. I cheat for free.
That's quite terrible. Yeah, that's quite terrible. But it's, they don't, it's know fine. The difference. Nobody expects anything less from you.
Yeah, well, if you're not cheating, you're not trying.
My almost 4-year-old was beating me in a race, and I kind of nudged her to knock her down so I could win. If that makes
wait a minute.
Better.
She was really beating you?
I mean, she had the upper hand. I mean, I was on, you know, I wasn't really running, but like, she thought she was going to win, so I had to do something. So I just nudged her a little bit.
God, your 4-year-old girl is outrunning you. You've got to do
something.
She
got off balance.
You got
it. I'm working on it, man.
I need to work a little harder.
Pumpkin roll, baby. Eat that pumpkin roll.
What?
Pumpkin roll. Check it out. If you've never heard of pumpkin roll, try it. It's probably the best, one of the best fall desserts there is.
Okay. You should, yeah. I mean, if you want to get outran by a 4-year-old child, then go ahead. Continue on the path. Yeah, are you ready? You want me to do your introduction?
Yes, please.
It's time for the outlaw candle connoisseur himself. As he wipes the spit off of his mouth from the excitement from the candle of the month. What's the candle of the month? Burn it up.
You know, I won't give us much credit for many things, but you name me another podcast that does this, all right? A candle of the month.
I mean, there's probably a whole podcast dedicated to candles, so.
Yeah, but they're not. They don't know what we know. All right, this month's candle comes to us from Yankee Candle. It's Yankee for all of you who thought I said something else. And the description, before I get to the title, the autumn evening invites with brisk earthy notes and dreamy interludes of lavender and woodland whispers.
Damn.
Dun, dun, damn. Dun. Crisp fall night. Is the candle of the month. Like I said, it's on. I was on back order because it is a bestseller. I also believe it's on sale if you want to head over there and check it out. Half off, but I will have it soon. But a couple people recommended it to me. I took a look at it. It looks awesome. Color looks great. Comes in 2 and 3 wicks. Obviously, I'm always gonna recommend the more wicks.
Right, more wicks. But, can't go wrong with more wicks.
Check it out. Crisp fall night is the Candle of the Month by Yakey.
Now, when you get a recommendation, right, like how does someone say you should try this candle? That they just randomly give this to you? Like, how does this go that you just get suggested candles by people?
I mean, some people stop. You know, one of these people, actually, their husband listens to us and happened a while back to tell her about that I do a candle thing. And she's a big candle person. And we were just talking the other day about life, and the podcast got brought up, and she was like, oh, you're still doing the candle thing. I'm like, yeah. And then she, you know, so the word has gotten out there. And I don't accept any money from these companies. I don't.
Well, they're not offering it. So, but if they did, I'm sure you certainly would.
Why do you have to blow this? Let the people think what they're going to think.
Here's my other question for you, right? Let's say one of your candle buddies, a woman, wants you to go candle shopping with her, and your wife isn't coming. Could you get away with going candle shopping with another woman?
Yeah, absolutely.
Whoa.
100%. Yep. I have no doubts. I have a fantastic wife who would never stand between me and my passions. And I don't mean going shopping with other women. I mean going to a candle store.
Okay. Is there a candle destination that you'd like to go someday in your life? Like, you know, football fans want to go to Canton, see the Hall of Fame. Where does John Shaw, candle connoisseur, want to go someday to see the best candle store in America?
I actually don't know if there is a candle Hall of Fame. You think there
probably
is?
Probably not.
Oh.
They've all burned away. You know what? Yeah, I've lost interest. Are you ready for our top five?
Just so you know, there's a National Candle Association, which I think I need to be involved.
You got us to join up. You could be president someday.
Oh, thank you. I could be anything I wanted to be, except an astronaut, because my mom told me I was too fat from age 5. Mm. So, all right.
Well, technically, she wasn't. I mean, she wasn't wrong.
Yeah, what a way to crush a child's dreams.
Well, would you rather be told you're too fat or too dumb? Yeah, that's right. Like, you can do something about the one.
Oh, that's tough, though, man. Like, if someone were to come to me and go, you could go into space, but, you know, you're too dumb or too fat, I almost think I'd rather be told I'm too dumb, because at least I have a legitimate reason.
Oh, yeah, I could see that, right? Like, well, what am I going to do? Nothing I can do about this.
Like, yeah. Anyways.
That's the way it goes. Top five things you don't want to get the cheap version of.
My number five is a mattress.
Mmm. Yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah, you don't. As I get older, it's kind of a theme of this episode, getting older. As I get older, I'm realizing that having a good mattress is important. Like getting a good night's sleep, which I don't, but at least laying in bed in a comfortable mattress is important.
How much you spend on your mattress?
Oh, I don't know. Probably. I mean, I know it was a couple $1,000.
Damn.
I mean, I know it's not that much, but it was enough.
Mine was like $500. What the fuck are you buying?
I don't know. We got one of these Tempur-Pedic memory foam ones. I don't know. But like I've had a shitty mattress. If that's all you can afford, that's fine. But I can tell you that having a nice mattress, it's going to be around for a while and it's comfortable. And my back doesn't hurt every morning.
Okay. I think the most I've ever spent on a mattress is $500.
Oh, well.
You went.
Even now, like, you're still sleeping on a cheap mattress.
Dawn!
Oh, boy.
I got to call one of my kids. If I find out how much our mattress is, I'll tell you this right now. If it's $1,000, I'm going to be pissed off.
Of course it is.
I'm going to find out.
The fact that you don't know how much it is means it was expensive.
I know. I don't want to find out. My number five is toilet paper. Don't go cheap on toilet paper. Get the nicer stuff.
I actually have something along those lines, but it's a little further down my list. So.
Okay.
But I agree with you.
Number four.
So my number four is shoes.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. That becomes, for people who are younger listening to this, as you get older into the mid-30s, you gotta get better shoes.
Yeah, but, like, I don't want the young kids who listen to this to think that, like, a pair of Jordans for $180 is what I'm talking about. I mean, like, a good comfortable, you know, durable pair of shoes. Like I might buy 2 to 4 pairs of shoes a year.
Yeah, you gotta forget about style and start going with structure. Like it's gotta be a well made pair of shoes.
You got to, man.
Yeah, you got it. You got knees to. And important. Back. Ankles, neck, shoulders. Everything hurts as you get older.
Oh, it does.
My number 4 is a haircut. Don't go get a $5 haircut, right? Like,
I mean, I guess coming from us, by the way, if you're listening to this and actually have like a hairdresser or get your hair cut by a professional, don't listen to this. But my haircut's only like $15. I mean, I don't think that's expensive at all.
I go pretty cheap with a haircut, but I'm just not going snip and clip $6 cheap, right? Like, I'm going to go up to the $12 to $18 range.
Yeah, there used to be a, I forget the chain, but it was like $5 for a haircut or something.
Yeah. Well, and, it's going to be worth $5. Yeah. You do get what you pay for. What's your number 3?
So this one's kind of a cop out, but I have paper towel, kind of a long, it's not toilet paper. Cause I feel like toilet paper, you can suffer through, but, paper towel, man, if you have the cheap stuff that just rips in your hand or like isn't absorbent, it's the worst effing crap out there.
Do you actually use one sheet of paper towel when you're cleaning something?
Never. And I'm the worst. Like that's probably the one thing I need to get better at. Well, the one thing. That's something I need to get better at.
I don't think I've ever used less than probably 3 pieces of paper towel for anything that I'm doing.
I'm even worse, though, with toilet paper and Kleenex. You know, I go to grab a tissue, I'm grabbing like 6.
Oh, I'll grab 1 Kleenex, but if it comes to toilet paper, I'm probably 5 or 6 things deep before I even think that I'm protected. I could never just rip off 1 piece and do that. I don't think anybody ever has, to be honest with you. Did you do your number 3 already?
Yeah, I just did it.
My number 3 is any repair you can't do yourself. Like if you're getting estimates for roofing or electrical work or auto mechanics, don't go with the cheapest one, right? Like if you've got an estimate for a roof and there's a bunch of people at 10 grand and somebody says, "I'll do it for 5." You should probably go ahead and get that 10 grand one.
Yeah, that was going to be my number 1, but I'm changing it now not to reflect it being on both lists. But that's obviously smart. I'll say that's smarter than better. My number 2 is you need a good set of tires.
Oh, that is a good one. I didn't think about that. Yeah, you don't want to go cheap on tires.
Yeah, you definitely do not want to go cheap. I did that 1 year. And my tire blew out, and thank God I wasn't driving at the time because I'd been drinking, and who knows what would have happened.
That's good. Yeah, okay. I've had tire blowout on the road. That's not a fun thing to have happen to you. My number 2, I put parachute, but I would say that anything that kind of protects your life, like don't buy the cheapest helmet or medical equipment. Like, get the nicer version of it.
Okay, I mean, I'm a little iffy. Like, I'm looping medicine in there, too, like with the medical stuff. Most of that stuff you can get much cheaper generic versions, which is just the same thing.
But, yeah, but I'm not talking about, like, medication. I mean, like, look, if you're going to buy a helmet, don't get the cheapest motorcycle helmet you can find. Like, let's get a nicer one.
You don't want to end up concussed.
You gonna bring up your boy Tua? Say something offensive again?
No, I'm not. I wasn't offensive. At least I didn't think it was offensive. My number 1: you do not want to go cheap on food. And food, from the grocery store to restaurants, obviously you're paying for what you get for the most of the time. I mean, I think we've talked about it before about my distaste for like Kroger cereal when I could get the name brand for 30 cents more and it's much better.
I actually completely disagree with you. Not only do I disagree that that's not worthy of being on the top 5, I would actually say the opposite, right? If I had a choice between the nicest Mexican dinner I can find or Taco Bell, I'm going to Taco Bell every day of the week. Like, hey, you want to go to La Fancy Pants? No. You want to go Taco Bell? Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also coming from a guy who, you know, you don't cook very much. I don't think you...
Give me the garbage. Give me the $1.99 mega box of cereal.
It pains me when I'm walking, and there's only one store that still has these, but it's the big plastic bags of cereal, like the 10-pound bags. And I'm like, that's dog food. Like, that is dog food that people... And I... Listen, I'm not... I want to make this clear. If that's what you can afford, great. Like, I've been there. I get it. I'm not picking on anybody if that's what they can afford. But, man, if I have a choice over things you should not buy cheap, it's food. And that goes into that category.
My number one is condoms. Birth control measures. Don't go cheap when it comes to birth control measures, men or women. Get the...
That's what...
Right? Like, if it's $1.99 for a six-pack, let's go ahead and get the nicer ones.
You know, I'm not really well versed in condoms, so I guess I'm gonna defer everything.
That's why you got two kids.
So, well, you know. I don't even know. I'm sure that, what did they make, like, value condoms?
I don't even know anymore. I mean, my wife and I have been married for 10 years. No, wait, that's not true. Yeah, we've been together for 11 years, so you know your boy.
Yeah. Like, I mean,
raw dog in it.
I mean, listen, more power to you. Yeah, I'm not sure if I would, like, walk into that aisle, if I would even... You know, you have like the $22.99 box and then a $4.99 box. It'd be real hard to turn down the $4.99 box.
I would be real easy to turn down the $4.99 box, right? Like, you're doing this for a reason. You should probably invest, make that investment and go ahead and like bump that dollar up a little bit, right? I'm not saying you got to get the $30 lambskin special, but let's not get the $2.99 value pack. Oof. Sponsored by, like, I don't know, somebody like Nick Cannon and his 15 kids, right? Like, that's...
I mean, or, you know, I'm sure we all saw that viral picture of the reporter in Hurricane Ian that used a condom as a mic cover. That was a classy use of a cheap condom, I hope.
Yeah, I would think that somebody and her boss would be having a conversation with her. What's in your honorable mention? I actually have a lot.
I don't... You know what? I don't really have that much.
I guess I don't have...
I don't think anything outside the realm of kind of what you touched on. So what's on your honorable?
Insurance. You should get decent insurance, right? If you're going to do it, get the right stuff. Romance. Don't go cheap when it comes to romance.
Wait, okay, no, elaborate. When you mean romance, do you mean like strippers?
Well, really anything in that regard, right?
Okay.
Like, I don't care if it's something for your wife, your girlfriend, your significant other, a prostitute. Don't go cheap, right? That's a good one. Prostitutes.
Yeah, you don't want...
Go
listen,
up,
young men
spend
and women.
More on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, just, you know what? Don't waste your time on taking them out to dinner. But yes, everything else, don't, you know, spend up.
Eye protection.
Yeah, okay.
They're just your eyes. Don't worry about it. Okay, that's going to go ahead and do it for this episode of Profoundly Pointless. I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, subscribe, leave us a rating or a review. We really appreciate it. It helps us out. We do have a YouTube channel as well. It's interesting, right? Because I do think that there is a side of these interviews that you don't necessarily get just in the audio version. So if you want to check out any of the videos that we have, we are Profoundly Pointless on YouTube. Let us know what you think, though, are some of the things that, man, you just can't go cheap there.